They've answered every question definitively, such that there's no more room for mystery, for questioning, for curiosity, or for degrees of differentiation in your beliefs.
From Interfaith Alliance, this is The State of Belief. I'm Interfaith Alliance President Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch in New York City.
And that rigidity is really what I think hampers the witness of evangelicals today.
It was wise of the creators of the documentary God and Country to include the voice of Jamar Tisby in their important project. The author of several best-selling books on race and religion, Jamar is a historian, author, and speaker at the intersection of the issues most impacting our nation today. This week, Jamar is with us to discuss white Christian nationalism, racism in the church, and our culture, and his vision for healing from the status quo through what he calls courageous Christianity. As we celebrate the 18th anniversary of the State of Belief, I want to make sure you're subscribed to the next generation of the State of Belief podcast. Please visit stateofbelief.com/newpodcast. You'll hear this episode in full, as well as recent conversations with Manu Meal, Najiba Saeed, Dr. Anathea Butler, Father Jim Martin, Rabbi Sharon Brous, as well as my exclusive interview with Rob Reiner and Dan Partland about their essential new documentary film on Christian nationalism, God and Country. It would really help us to have you subscribe, rate, and tell people you're close to about all you're hearing. The State of Belief is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation, thank you for helping get these conversations heard by more people who need them. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how to do that is available at stateofbelief.com, and you can find out more about the work of Interfaith Alliance and join us at interfaithalliance.org. And now to my guest. Dr. Jamar Tisby is professor of history at Simmons College in Louisville, Kentucky. His perspectives on race, religion, history, and justice come both from study and experience. He is the author of two important books, The Color of Compromise, The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism, as well as How to Fight Racism, Courageous Christianity, and the Journey Towards Racial Justice. He has an upcoming book, The Spirit of Justice, Stories of Faith, Race, and Resistance. That's dropping soon. You can also find him at a Substack, Jamar Tisby, and he has a podcast, Pass the Mic Podcast. So we are introducing you into a media legend and also a really, really important voice right now. And it is an honor to welcome you to the State of Belief, Dr. Tisby.
Thank you so much. I'm going to add that media legend part to my pass the mic intro on the podcast. I like that.
1,000%. Yeah, yeah. People are saying I'm a media legend. Yeah. It's evident, and pretty soon everyone is saying I'm a media legend. Listen, I have been an admirer from afar. This is our first time really having an opportunity to have an in-depth conversation. And I think for our listeners who may not be acquainted with your work yet, I think it's so important. And you do storytelling so well. So beautifully. And also, you have a great website, by the way. I'll mention that as well. Speaking of media legend, but JamarTisby.com is a great website to learn more about all of your work, but also about you. And maybe you can, you know, just introduce this conversation with a narrative about where you come from and your history and what brings you to all of this crucial work you're doing today.
I think if anyone has heard of me or knows my work, it stems from the mere fact that I am an evangelical reject. Came to faith in a white evangelical context. It was a high school youth group. They had it all mapped out, boy. They had food, they had games, they had girls, you know, no high school guy could resist. And they also had these brief sermonettes that the youth pastor would do. And I kept going, and along the way, it started to click, this Jesus thing, and I became a Christian. And I had just this classic evangelical conversion story right down to praying the sinner's prayer. Didn't know as a teenager was just how embedded race was into religion, particularly evangelicalism. So I, of course, noticed I was always one of the only or one of a few people of color in these spaces. This is the 90s. This is seeker sensitive era, church growth, all that stuff. So, right, you know, right. Homogenous.
What part of the country did you grow up in?
Near Chicago suburbs.
Okay.
Willow Creek was big at point.
Sure.
And so I'm in that whole mix. I go to college. I have a very mixed Christian background. So much of my schooling has been in Catholic schools. So there was always God talk there. I also think it's because I went to a Catholic college that I began moving towards social justice work. You know, they have the Catholic social tradition, right? And there was a Center for Social Concerns on campus, which many, many years later, I was reflecting. I was like, would you ever find something like that on an evangelical campus, right? A Center for Social Concerns.
Well, you would, but the social concerns would be very prescriptive.
Exactly.
You know, about what,
exactly.
You know, yeah.
What counted as social and you could approach. Because racism was always sort of positioned as a distraction from the gospel. I mean, literally people would say that. So anyway, got into social justice work through some service projects there, but also was encountering something called Reformed theology, which was even whiter than evangelicalism.
So this is at Notre Dame. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's at Notre Dame. It was not through like the university, any formal channels. Books I'm reading and things of that nature, and start going to Reformed churches, Dutch Reformed churches at that. So not only am I the only Black person, and I don't mean one of the only, I mean the only Black person. And I didn't know that Dutch people run tall, apparently. So Paul, you would fit right in. You're quite a bit taller than I am, but I was an outsider in every way.
Yeah. Actually, there's a visual. I want to talk to you about God and country eventually, but there is a visual there where you're kind of standing next to a few folks. I don't know when that was taken exactly, but it is like a little bit like, okay, you know.
That's it. That was pretty typical.
But I do think like people who don't know Reformed theology, it was a very strong movement. It still is. But I think that this era you're talking about, people were very interested in what might be like kind of pure Christianity. Mm-hmm. And that was like, I don't know. It seemed like Reform always wanted to be like, we're the essential. We're like really going down to we're stripping it down we're talking about what matters. And it was a very theologically, you know, extremely theologically conservative movement, but it also kind of claimed Christianity in almost an aggressive way that anyone who wasn't doing that wasn't really a Christian.
Exactly. There are various branches of Reformed theology, like with any tradition, but the one I was in was pretty much the most conservative one. And they wouldn't necessarily say this precisely the way I'm going to say it, but this was the undertone: is we get religion right.
Yeah.
We get Christianity right. That's right. and everyone else is degrees of wrongness. So, you know, for me, it scratched an intellectual itch. I mean, it was very
theologically
precise.
It's rigorous. And that's why I think some people like you, like they like the rigor. It's not just like you just go, you know, and adopt a few like, you know, flimsy ideas. You have to go into it and you have to work to get it. And so they attract often very, you know, not always, but like when I worked at Princeton, for instance, I worked at the university and it attracted like very intelligent people who were interested in the discipline of that theology. But it also comes with a certain framework that doesn't allow for a lot of broader questions to be introduced into the gospel.
Exactly. I wrote a Substack article that got a lot of traction. It was based on a phrase I heard from a Jewish guy, actually, who had a lot of interaction with conservative evangelicals. And he said, they always strike me as the people who don't have any questions. And that really resonated with me.
If you want to scare me, tell me the people who don't have any questions. Yeah.
And,
wow.
And what he's getting at is they've answered all the questions, right? Like if there are questions about who God is, how we should act, how the world should be, they've answered every question definitively, such that there's no more room for mystery, for questioning, for curiosity, or for degrees of you know, differentiation in your beliefs. And that rigidity is really what I think hampers the witness of evangelicals today.
All right. Well, so this is, I think that's very helpful because it also illuminates a lot of the, what you're, you know, what eventually became your work. But continue with the narrative. You've been to Notre Dame. You've begun to be introduced to some questions that, and simultaneously, you're in a faith that doesn't really welcome all those questions. So where do you go from there?
Yeah, so it is that simultaneity, if that's a word, of after graduation, I joined Teach for America, and I became a sixth grade science and social studies teacher in a part of the country most people don't know much about, the Mississippi Delta, and I'm on the Arkansas side, and I'm in the fourth poorest county in the country, and all of these quote-unquote social issues now have a human face. And they're walking into my classroom every day, the families and the community that I'm interacting with. And that is happening, this exposure to generational injustice in the form of racism and economic exploitation is clashing now with this reformed and evangelical tradition I'm in, which doesn't seem to have much to say about these real world material social issues. And so I'm starting to ask questions of my faith, and what does my faith have to do with what I'm seeing every day in the Delta?
Oh my God. Eventually, it's so interesting. It's like, you know, when you don't have questions, you know, any questions like the ones you're introducing are beside the point.
Exactly.
You know, there's like the point, and then there's the beside the point. And I think what you're doing is saying, actually, this is the point, and like, how does it illuminate the questions of a Christian or the gospel, but if it's not allowed in the conversation, that becomes an antiseptic faith and devoid of real blood, which I think the idea is
pretty important.
Sorry to interrupt. Keep going.
You're homing in on something really important here, which is that we got to understand the subtleties here. It's not as if Reformed and evangelical leaders are saying we shouldn't care about anyone. But what they're saying is that's ancillary. That is, you know, they would use this language, core to the gospel or an implication of the gospel. And the idea that what is core to the gospel is these sort of lofty theological questions about salvation and redemption and all of these sort of intellectually rigorous kind of questions, right? And then anything besides that, particularly, and like you said, selective social issues. So if it was about abortion, they'd be all about that core, right to the gospel or some other issues. But if it's about addressing racism or poverty, well, you know, sure, but don't make too big a deal of that, because that's replacing the gospel. Well, it's not core.
Well, so, and also the poor will also always be with us. You know, there's a proof texting where you we have an answer for that.
Don't trouble yourself too much, because
you know, it's your eternal salvation at stake. And I'm sorry that they're poor, but that's just the way it is. So I'm being flippant, but you're talking about, I mean, it is underneath it is something very real. And so I really appreciate that. So this must have created this sort of, okay, so what do I do about it moment for you?
So the plan was, and you know how God likes our plans. The plan was go to seminary, come back to the Delta, be a pastor, and arrogantly, in for me, you know, show these folks what church is really like, right? Like what churches should really be. Well, the way God did it is I did go to seminary. I went to Reformed Theological Seminary, which is uber conservative, and got exposed to firsthand the racism in many of these white churches. So, you know, there's a lot of different episodes and stories I can talk about. But when I was at seminary, I started something called the African American Leadership Initiative. And I mentioned that because that was some of my early exposure to the naysaying, the whispering, the backbiting that went on for people who were engaged in racial justice work. And it hurt me to the core. As we were doing this group, I remember one member of our group who was white just sort of offhandedly said, yeah, some of the other students have been talking about AALI and how it's a distraction from the gospel. They're questioning why you're doing it, blah, blah, blah. The reason that hurt or cut so deep was because these are the folks I'm sitting next to in class. We're playing pickup games of basketball and ultimate frisbee. We're collaborating, right? And unbeknownst to me, they think that what I'm doing and what I'm involved in is not, quote unquote, truly biblical. And mind you, none of them came to me directly. The most direct you got was maybe a comment on Facebook or something. But I was like, oh, this is like near. This is right next to me. This is not some racism far off. This is right here in the camp, so to speak. And there are many, many, many other incidents like that. But, you know, as you fast forward through time, whether it's the election of Obama as the first Black president, the rise of the Tea Party, the murder of Trayvon Martin, the rise of Black Lives Matter after the Mike Brown's killing, all of these things add up to you can be Black or Christian, but you can't be both. And I said, wait a minute. God may be Black on purpose. That's not an accident, and it's not something that I need to shed or leave behind to be Christian. It's part of who I am as a Christian. And so that led me to, you know, essentially, I volunteered to remove myself, but it was very clear that in the circles I was in, the work I was doing and what I represented wasn't welcome.
I think, you know, I appreciate you saying that, and the pain that's behind such a thing, because this is like a betrayal of a community, exactly. Of a member of a community. Up next, more with Jamar Tisby. You can hear full episodes of The State of Belief anytime on our website at stateofbelief.com. Better yet, make sure you subscribe to the Next Generation podcast at stateofbelief.com/newpodcast. You're listening to The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet.
Hey there, curious minds.
Get ready to embark on a unique journey at the crossroads of money and religion with our new podcast, Money Meet Meaning.
The seductive effect of money, we think it can do the work that God does because there's something about money that does that. It's wild.
I'm Amber Hacker.
And I'm Tom Levinson.
Tune in for a blend of wisdom and levity as we decode the path to a more meaningful relationship with money.
I think giving, and this is a little crass, but I feel like it's the ultimate middle finger to money. It's liberating to give some away.
This podcast is your gateway to a vibrant and thought-provoking exploration of the interconnectedness of wealth and spirituality.
Join us as we unravel the surprising influence of ancient wisdom on modern finances.
Faith pervades people's lives and our society. And because money is such an important part of people's lives, exploring that intersection of faith and money, I think, is super, super interesting.
Get ready to be informed, entertained, and inspired to transform your financial outlook with Money Meet Meaning. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The State of Belief. I'm Interfaith Alliance President Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. My guest is scholar and best-selling author Dr. Jamar Tisby. I will say that you did not go out without a fight, and I don't mean that pejorative. I mean that in a positive way. You actually gave people the opportunity to engage these ideas in a very, I would say, like quite. Welcoming and engaging and approachable way. You were like, okay, I actually respect you all enough and this tradition that gave me my conversion enough to engage you about these questions. And so, like, you know, you did this, that one organization, but also you continued to try to engage that community and say, can we talk about this? And it's just, it's part of a broader a broader effort by Black Christian leaders who live predominantly within white Christian spaces to say, can we all grow? I mean, you know, I think about the Southern Baptist Convention, which, you know, I mean, its origins are racist. You know, I mean, like, it's not like it's a mystery or something like that. Like, you know, it's very clear. The Southern Baptist Convention was started so that, you know, slave owners could own people, you know. And so, but what you were trying to do was really engage this in a way that was human to everyone. And I just find, you know, honestly, like, my temperament is to a fault is like, you know, see ya, you know, I mean, right, I'm very right. Like, that's like, it's very hard for me to, you know, to fight that, because I get very defensive, and I'm like, right now in this moment we're in, I have to fight constantly from not just being totally in a fighter's stance. And what you offered, I think, and it's important to underline this, and that's the reason I'm spending some time on it, is that you actually were creating avenues for a conversation. And I think that was a very generous stance. And yet, you know, from my understanding of your life story, you've actually been penalized for doing exactly that.
Stiff arm. Yeah. So we created something called the Reformed African American Network, which is now The Witness, a Black Christian collective. And that's a story in and of itself of the name change. But I mean, folks like me in my generation, we really believed this racial reconciliation stuff.
Yeah.
We believed it when white churches and Christian leaders said they wanted reconciliation, they wanted diversity, et cetera, et cetera. So we came into, quote unquote, their spaces, their nonprofits, their churches, their seminaries in good faith. And we gave a good faith effort to expand the narrative, to be a faithful presence. And to this day, there are people of color in those spaces, and God bless you. But it's a minority, but it's a vocal and a powerful minority that really pushes back against this substantive change that must take place. One of the things that's on my mind recently is, you know, I'll probably record a reel for this for Instagram or something, the difference between desegregation and integration. The difference between desegregation and integration. So legally, schools, businesses, churches had to desegregate, meaning they had to remove the barriers for entry. But that's a passive thing. It's the difference between unlocking a door and opening the door, going out on the street and inviting people in and then making them feel welcome. So if you use the diversity, equity, inclusion, DEI framework, that would be more of the inclusion part, right? So a lot of these Christian spaces desegregated, but they didn't integrate. They didn't really incorporate Black people and other people of color, namely our cultures, our questions that we bring to theology and to God, didn't really incorporate that into the life of the organization or the congregation. And so that's the rub.
That's the rub. But it's also, I'll say, like, it's the missed opportunity, because, you know, just from my own personal experience, I went to Union Seminary in New York and came in there kind of like not really knowing why I was in seminary, to be frank. I didn't have the kind of calling that you had, but I had a calling because I showed up on the doorstep. And I didn't realize what I was really there to learn, which was really be in proximity for 3 years with James Cone and with many of my colleagues there, who really, you know, kind of literally brought me to my knees around race in America in an approximate way, which I, as incredibly imperfect as I am now, it did change the way I understood the gospel, and it changed the way I understood, my role in America and my role in as a faith leader. And I think that's what you were offering them, that opportunity, is like, it's not enough to like learn from these people. It has to translate to what does our faith mean in light of these experiences. And that's like, you know, that's the, you know, that's, you know, there's a metaphor that my great grandfather, Walter Rauschenbusch, used, where it was like, before he had proximate interactions with the poor who were dying in Hell's Kitchen, he thought the gospel was one thing. And then he says, it was as if I was, as if I was going through this forest, and all around me, the birds were alive with song, and it was beautiful, and all. But I didn't hear any of it because I was a botanist, and all I was looking down and looking at plants, and I didn't see the stories that were there. And so, I think, you know, for him, he used as that the metaphor of like, and all of a sudden, I looked at the gospel and saw how much Jesus talked about the poor. And how much Jesus talked about, you know, how much he loved and cared for those who are on the margin and outside. And it changed the whole, you know, it changed the way that he understood what the gospel was meant to do in this world. And I think that that's the analogy and, you know, for all the failings of the social gospel, you know, but that is an offering of the social gospel, that people matter in order to illuminate religion. And
that's
I think that's
an important concept. Yeah.
Yeah.
That proximity. So, I mean, I refer to it as a priestly proximity. If you think of the best kind of ministers, the best kind of shepherds and pastors, they are close to the people they serve.
Right.
They know what
they're going
through.
I mean, think about Dorothy Day. She has all the authority in the world because she was with the people and never left the people. So anything
that's
she
right.
was talking about, like she was, it was completely. And so the worker houses to this day are like proximate. And I think that's what you offered. And here you are, like, you know, I think what is the terrible absurdity of this moment is that you have become you. You are the face of wokeness. How dare you? I mean, it's just, you know, I think that that is, you know, honestly, I love the fact that you're the face of wokeness. I think, you know, because I view that as a positive. You know, I mean, awake, we're awake. We need to see. We can be awake in this world. I mean, that's the idea behind it, is like, you know, it's a term for being aware of what's happening in the world and responding to it. But unfortunately, it's like, it's been, you know, denigrated by people who, for the mere fact that you're talking about race and religion, you have been put on these no-go lists. And I was reading, like, what happened at Grove College, and it just, like, that's really, I honestly, it just made me so, it was not Christian, my thoughts. I mean, I was just really like, God, you guys are really just turning your back on anything that matters. And, you know, you tell the story of that if you don't mind. I think it's just helpful for people to understand what this kind of quote unquote war on woke can yield. And of course the victims are the students who are trying to learn and grow.
Thank you for bringing that up. It really robs the students of the kind of education they need as early as possible on race and justice. So Grove City, I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, because get this, they invite me. And by they, I mean they're essentially equivalent of like their multicultural coordinator staff person, right? I get invited. This is 2020, October 2020. So it's just before the presidential election. It's Western Pennsylvania. I've never seen so many Trump signs plastered all over billboards, houses, fences. And I'm driving in. I'm like, what have I got myself into? But I will go. If you invite me, I will go and I will speak what my truth, right? So I go, and the experience is fine. It's clearly a very conservative college and student body. There's some, you know, light disagreement in questions from students, right? But nothing outlandish. Mm-hmm. I go and I move on to the next thing. Not until a year later does this online petition come out called Save GCC from CRT. Save Grove City College from Critical Race Theory. And it's put by these alumni, by these donors, very few student participation at all. But basically, it's listing all of these reasons why Grove City College is going down this wrong, left, liberal, woke path. And among their grievances, they name my appearance at the college a year prior. And it somehow came on my radar online. I'm like, what is this? So I just start following it and tracking it. They accused the president of Grove City College of basically sleeping on the job. So he comes under fire. He issues a public statement saying, no, we're not going woke.
And an apology, I think, or maybe I'm jumping the gun, but there was like, it was almost, an apology? Oh, we did this terrible thing of like having a student interaction with an idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
A person. Well,
and it was really, came down to one particular professor writing an article that basically said, well, we might listen to someone like Jamar Tisby in a classroom where there's sort of intellectual debate, but having him in chapel, that sends a different message. That was the rub. And I promise you, you can go back now and listen to that chapel message. I've got a whole series on my Substack with links to it, or you just look at Jamar Tisby Grove City College, whatever. Listen to it. It is very not inflammatory. Mm. I mean, I did not pull punches, but I knew my audience and what they were ready for. They were 101. They were not level 301 or 401, right? It is not, you know, just some woke screed, right? Where I'm decrying all white Christians or whatever. The punchline of the sermon, not that it was a joke, but the core message of the sermon was, use this time as a college student to learn about race and about history.
Oh yeah.
That was the message.
Well, that does turn into a punchline because they don't want them to do that.
Exactly. Apparently.
I'm sorry that, I'm not sorry. I'm not like, I don't feel particularly responsible for exactly that incident, but like, because of your background, you actually care about a segment of the population that many of us, and maybe you're beginning to realize that you just can't. But you feel akin in some ways to that population in a way that I don't. Mm. You know, the hardcore white evangelical community is not something that I have particular experience with and I don't have particular sympathies with, although I do interact with them and then I'm always like, oh, maybe, that's where my own like prejudice comes in, et cetera. But I want to just take a minute to talk about the experience of recording and working with Rob Reiner and Dan Parklin around the God and Country film, because you have such an important witness there. And there's just so many amazing things you say. You're just like, I just was so challenged and invigorated by what you said simultaneously. But you just, in the 2016 election, you just say they didn't really take any of my concerns seriously. The fact that evangelicals voted at 81% for Donald Trump, white evangelicals. And it personalized in some ways the white Christian nationalism conversation so much, because it's also like for a Christian like yourself and someone who actually grew up in the same theological circles and with the same theological framework, they couldn't see why that was damaging for you.
That's right. That's right. It was a use the word betrayal earlier, and that's what it felt like. So I was at this predominantly white evangelical church in the Arkansas Delta and had committed to it. I mean, I was in leadership there. We had attended several years. And I remember watching the election results roll in and just feeling the sinking feeling like this is not going to be good for the country. It's not going to be good for Black people, immigrants, you name it, right? And I also knew at that very same time, there were people in my church who were celebrating. They were glad. You know, Christianity had come back to the White House. their concerns were being prioritized. And again, it's not distant. This is my church family. They have held my child in their arms. We've prayed together. We've shared meals together. We've been in each other's homes. And yet, for 81% of white evangelicals who voted to pull the lever for Trump and have that reality in my own church, it felt like, what am I even doing here? Do you even know what my reality is like? And here we are, by the way, in the Delta, in the town that we're in, is 75% Black.
Right.
The poverty rate is over 40%, at or below the poverty line. Nearly half the population is poor. And we're talking about proximity. There's ways that you can be in, but not among people in need.
Right.
You know, it's almost like, it's almost like that missionary mentality where, you know, for a lot of U.S. missions history, these white missionaries would go into different countries and they would serve in different ways, but they would really live separately and apart. You know, they wouldn't really be one among the people. And it was, that must have been happening, right? So anyway, I try to bring the experiential lived reality of things like white Christian nationalism to bear in my work. This is affecting real people in real congregations.
Right. And, you know, not to center white people, but white people do need, like, they need Jesus. You know, I mean, they need repentance. I mean, there has to be a reckoning. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. Talk to me a little bit about the book, How to Fight Racism, Courageous Christianity, and the Journey Towards Racial Justice. You know, in some ways, that feels like, and then I want to get to your next book. Like, you know, but I think that that's a really important offering to the Christian community. It's like, what does it look like to be courageous? And how do we actually take this challenge, this great, you know, monumental, fundamental challenge to America, but also many places around the world of racism within the church, but then also writ large? And what tools can Christianity offer us in that journey?
So all three books sort of fit together, and this wasn't necessarily my plan, God's plan, but I was just trying to be responsive to what I was hearing in this racial justice work. So the first book, The Color of Compromise, really outlines the problem. How did 11 o'clock a.m. become the most segregated hour in America, so to speak? And I think what struck a chord with The Color of Compromise is it used history as a vehicle to explain this. Looking at the past to illuminate the present and seeing things how the Southern Baptist Convention gets started. If you look at any denomination's name and it has Southern in the name, that means pro-slavery, right?
Yep.
So you know, there are obvious examples like that. There are more subtle examples all throughout the book. And then the last chapter of that book ends with essentially, well, what do we do now? And I spend just a little bit of time outlining that in The Color of Compromise, but How to Fight Racism is really a book-length response to that. And I think the primary contribution of How to Fight Racism is this framework I use called the Arc of Racial Justice. And that is an acronym that stands for Awareness, Relationships, Commitment. And I think you need all three, like the legs of a stool, to have a firm foundation for racial justice efforts. So awareness, that's all the data, information, knowledge that we need. You get that through documentaries, podcasts like this, books, et cetera. But there's also relationships. I think this is really the beating heart of racial justice, is that at the end of the day, it's all about people. It's all about love of neighbor. And so for white people, relationships means actually having meaningful relationships across racial and ethnic lines, which takes an incredible amount of intentionality because of the intentionality that went into segregating people from one another, white people from other people. For black people and people of color, I think relationships mean solidarity with other people of color, forming coalitions. We're stronger together than apart. And then the commitment aspect is not just staying the course. It's not just resolve. Commitment really gets to the systemic and the institutional aspects of racism, that we got to change policies. We've got to change laws. We've got to change systems in order to do something about racial inequality. So that answers the question I get most frequently, what do we do?
Right.
And while there are literally dozens and dozens of practical suggestions, that framework, the Arc of Racial Justice, is, I think, the primary contribution. And then that leads to the last book, The Spirit of Justice. Last book in the series, so to speak, the unintentional series. The Spirit of Justice is for people who are involved in this work and they're asking, how do we keep going? I begin with the story of Merle Evers, and you know, of course, she's the widow of Medgar Evers, the first field secretary for the NAACP in Mississippi. And She is one example of many people who lived through the civil rights movement who, when you ask them, how does now compare to then? They say it's as bad or worse.
Hmm.
And how deflating is that, right? She's in her 80s. And still we're fighting for voting rights. Still we're fighting for accurate racial history. Still we're fighting for integration and inclusion, right? So it can really be demoralizing when you think about how we're still fighting these battles. But in the spirit of justice, I talk about people who tapped into something that I call the spirit of justice to find a way to resist racism and injustice in their day so that we can continue the struggle in ours.
Mm. I think this is, you know, it's also, you know, it's, I think in terms of like kind of a prayer. I don't know. My mind goes to like hearing witnesses and hearing the stories of others who it can give you strength. We have just like a 1 minute left, but I like to ask every person who comes on this show about hope and what gives them hope in this moment. Jermar Tisby, what gives you hope?
A lot, actually. But one thing recently I heard historian Randall Balmer say is we don't have the luxury of despair. Despair is understandable given what we're up against, but it's also quite convenient because then you don't struggle anymore. Then you don't deal with injustice anymore. And I don't think as citizens in this nation, nor as citizens of God's kingdom, we have the luxury to give up. We have the luxury of despair because people are still suffering. So another way others have put it, we're prisoners of hope. We are hemmed in by hope because we believe in Jesus, who in the most hopeless of circumstances, death, overcame it. So, I mean, how can we be followers of Jesus and not have hope? But on a practical level, I get hope from folks like you doing the work on the front lines, teaching, educating, advocating. And these are small points of light, right? In the darkness, we're not a majority, but you only need a pinpoint of light to illuminate, right? And then as well, history gives me hope. When I learned about people like, say, for instance, Fannie Lou Hamer, poor sharecropper, yet becomes a nationally known civil rights figure and has deep belief and faith in Christ. Learning those stories from history, real life stories of people who overcame and continued the struggle, those things give me hope.
Dr. Jermar Tisby is a best-selling author, national speaker, and public historian. His books include The Color of Compromise, The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism, and How to Fight Racism, Courageous Christianity, and the Journey Towards Racial Justice. And coming soon, The Spirit of Justice, Stories of Faith, Race, and Resistance. Follow him at jermartisby.substack.com and Pass the Mic Podcast. Jermar, thank you so much for joining me today on The State of Belief.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to get you on our podcast so I can ask you all the questions I'm dying to ask. But this is
I'm ready. I'm ready. Let's do it. Please be sure to subscribe to The State of Belief at Apple Podcast or your favorite podcast platform or at stateofbelief.com/newpodcast. We need your help to keep making The State of Belief. Become a partner in this crucial work with a financial contribution today. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And share what you're getting out of this show with people in your networks. Let's get more people listening and keep these conversations going on Facebook and Instagram with the handle at State of Belief. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Religion News Service or Religion News Foundation. The State of Belief is produced by Ray Kirstein and is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. and be sure to join us next week. I can't wait. Until then, I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch on The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet.